Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How long could you keep yourself alive and sane if you were trapped in a steep crevasse with your right forearm crushed between the wall and a massive boulder and almost no hope that anyone would find you? That's the situation that now world-famous climber Aaron Ralston found himself in the spring of 2003, when he spent more than 5 days alone in Utah's Blue John Canyon, finally escaping after an act both desperate and courageous. Ralston's hellish days alone are the subject of a gripping new film by director Danny Boyle, whose previous works include Trainspotting, Sunshine, The Beach, and the Academy Award-winning Slumdog Millionaire. Danny Boyle is here now to talk about it. Danny, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Very nice to be here.
Is this one of those stories that when you first heard it on the news, you thought, this would be a great film?
I don't know whether I thought it was a great film. It snagged in my brain like sometimes stories do, and it happened worldwide because I was in London. I live in London, and I remember waiting to find out what had happened to him, because when it broke in the news was obviously when he got out, and then I was waiting weeks for follow-up news with the press conference he eventually gave. And then I read his book in 2006, mm-hmm. and I remember that's when I thought I had an idea of how to do it, of how I wanted to present it. And I approached him about doing it. But at that time, he wanted to make it as a documentary. He didn't want to make it as a feature. And he wanted to be interviewed and I guess, understandably, control the proceedings, really, in some way, which is, you know, because you know the reputation of Hollywood and real life stories. They can get chewed up quite badly. And he was very rightly cautious about that. So we separated and agreed to meet again another time. And 3 years later, we'd had a big hit with Slumdog. And I think that helped him appreciate that I could make films decently and that I'd be respectful to his story. And he'd also met someone, actually, very important in his life, who changed him, I think, and made him less controlling. And because you have to hand over to a feature film, you have to hand over a certain amount of control. And you hope when you get it back, it's decent, but there's no guarantees, you know.
He also had a video camera with him when this was all taking place. Have you actually seen those tapes?
Yes, he had a little Canon Elura camera, a domestic video camera, which this is 3 years before YouTube was born. He recorded everything he did on these climbing expeditions, and he recorded a series. Once he was trapped, he recorded a series of messages to his family, and the messages are extraordinary. And Aaron, bless him, gave us full access to them, although he's shown them to very few people.
They're not on YouTube. I actually looked to see if there was something that would compare with the film.
The one thing that isn't. Because he's not publicity shy as a person. But he'd promised his mom, I think, that he would never show these messages to anyone else. The messages are really basically for his mom. And he was very conscious that he was going to die and that he didn't want to leave a bad impression for her, that it was obviously going to be difficult enough for her anyway, but that he wanted her to see a dignified final will and testimony, I suppose. And they are extraordinary, the messages, because you're expecting them to be quite abject or distressing, but they're not. They're very, very dignified and noble, almost, you know, as he tries to make amends for things that he's overlooked in life. and that's one of the journeys of the film, is that he grows to appreciate people that perhaps he's taken for granted. And the messages are a testimony to that. And they were a huge inspiration for us making the film and for James Franco, who plays the part.
James Franco is really extraordinary in this. And I'm curious for you as a director how you have to manage the emotions of a single actor who really carries the entire film, is alone, I guess mostly on a soundstage for the entire filming or most of the scenes in the film, in terms of his energy, because he has to play someone who is getting weaker and more desperate as time goes on. But I have to imagine you have to feel okay yourself in order to act that well.
Yes, you do. I mean, for instance, one of the disintegrating things that happens to Aaron Ralston is the lack of water, which is a desperately dangerous thing to try and mimic. I mean, you hear about actors mimicking diets and weight loss, carbohydrate loss for parts, or putting on huge mm-hmm. amounts of weight. And you can play with that with a certain degree of safety, especially if it's monitored. But loss of water, we were told, don't even go there. Nobody can tell. You could die at any moment. So he's kept well hydrated, and we looked after him. But it's a burden, certainly, for an actor. I mean, fortunately, James is... He's one of those guys who I think he was ready for it to step up to the plate, really. I mean, there's a huge talent of a pool of actors, talent in America. There's certain ones of them, though, what I would call thoroughbreds, who are just waiting. They're kind of hungry for this kind of responsibility, where they have to take a film and carry it. And he was one of those. Despite his personality, when you meet him, you think he's stoned. I mean, he's virtually half asleep. You think, how's he ever going to get through this experience? It's a front. He's actually desperate for this kind of, to be fed this kind of challenge. And he took it on full on, yeah.
Did you have a number of actors read for that role?
Yeah, we did, actually. And James was one of them who agreed to read. And he was, when he read it, when we met him, we thought, Is he on drugs? He's not, actually, I have to tell you. He's a highly abstemious person on all fronts. But when he read it the second time, it was a step. Sometimes when you're making a film, you have these stepping stones that you step on, and they're solid. Yeah. So they're just a given. And that was like him. As soon as he opened his mouth, he's not a ringer. He doesn't look alike for Aaron Ralston in certain ways. But as soon as he started speaking, it was extraordinary. And we knew we had our Aaron Ralston for the film.
I think the great thing about the performance that we get from James Franco is that he portrays Aaron as being almost as afraid of losing his mind as of dying. Like, it's so important, and we feel the entire time, you know, that he doesn't want to lose it.
Yeah, it's a big, again, water loss, supposedly. After a couple of days, the brain begins to hallucinate. And it's certainly, you can see him, in the testimony he leaves in his book, you can see him trying to keep a grip on things, you know. It's desperate. I mean, he's a bit of a control freak anyway, so he's trying to, and that helps him a lot to organize. I think a lot of us are like that. We would organize ourselves in a place like that as best we could. And you see him at the beginning of the film laying out the bits of equipment he has got and figuring out how he can use it. And then he tries to organize himself for bedtime, you know, to give himself some kind of structure in the day and avoid the cold at night and things like that. But yes, he's trying to save it. But more importantly, really, than even hanging on to his sanity, is that he gets these moments of clarity. Now, I don't know whether he could trust them or not, because who knows when you're in that state, but he does, for us anyway, in a controlled drama, you do see him arrive at these moments of clarity where he acknowledges his responsibility in this event, and that in some kind of way he was almost willing it to happen, that he was seeking out more and more reckless challenges. Ironically, this particular day's travel is not particularly challenging for him at all. It's a walk in the park, in effect. And it's ironic, of course, that the moment happens, the key moment, the decisive moment, happens on a day when he's barely noticing what he's doing. It's so easy to him. And he goes on to acknowledge the part he plays in these events, and that he was destined to meet this rock, in a way. He's been moving towards it his whole life. So it's full of those wonderful insights which are part of his journey towards a kind of redemption, really, where he realises his culpability and also how he will grow as a person should he ever get out of here, that he will become more a part of humanity rather than someone who avoids it or not despises it, but kind of like turns his back on it in a way and seeks solitude.
We have a clip from a moment where he is starting to be a little bit delirious, and he makes a videotape as if he's doing a TV morning show. Let's listen to that now.
Good morning, everyone. It is 7 o'clock here in Canyonland, USA.
Hey, Aaron. Mom still has not heard from you. Will you just call her, please? I'll talk to you soon.
And this morning, on the Boulder, we have a very special guest, Aaron Ralston!
Oh, gosh, it's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you. Thank you.
Hey.
You lost? I'm a guide.
What'd he say?
See, I'm something of a big and hard hero.
All you have to remember is that everything will be okay.
Oh, my God. Aaron! Are you okay, Aaron?
Come on! You gotta come down here!
It's been nice knowing you, man.
Everything on my own.
See ya!
Bye!
I don't think we figured in his day at all.
Hey there, Aaron.
Is it true
you didn't tell anyone where you were going? Oops.
This marks 24 hours of being stuck. I've been chipping away. Want to keep warm anything? I have about 150 milliliters of water left. Which should keep me alive till tomorrow night, if I'm lucky. So that's it. Mom, Dad, I haven't appreciated you as I know that I could. I love you guys, and I'll always be with you.
think that clip's actually taken from the trailer of 127 Hours. So we hear two different scenes there. But in the beginning part, when he's there and he's pretending he's on this morning show, it's incredibly funny. And I found the audience, everybody really needed a break at that point. How did you manage that when you were figuring out how to adapt this and realize you can't take an hour and a half of that kind of agony?
Well, it's also about the human spirit. And I think one of the most extraordinary things about us is that when things turns really dark, we have this sense of humor about it, or we can have, which keeps the faintest spark of hope alive, even in the worst possible circumstances. And he is funny, Aaron, about it. You know, he tells jokes about it. Even on his messages, he would say funny things that are like highly inappropriate to the circumstances, except the fact, of course, it's his circumstances. He can do what the hell he likes on them. It's funny, actually. You were talking about James Franco, and the key thing with James was, funnily enough, and was Pineapple Express, because he'd been a very straight actor and very intense actor. And then he did this film in Pineapple Express, which is a very, very funny performance. I remember seeing that thinking, that's a serious actor, when you can make that arc between, yeah. You know. And we exploited that in the film whenever we could. And this monologue, it's like a monologue. It's sort of like a Shakespearean monologue, because it's just him alone. And he's talking to this camera, and he starts to perform. And Aaron admitted that he did perform in a way. He didn't exactly say these things, but he did perform to try and keep his spirits up. He did entertain himself. You can imagine the chatter going on with himself. And we have this wonderful vehicle to make that seem sensible and for it to reach out to us, which is through this umbilical cord of this video camera, really, which is the way that he reaches back to the people that he loves and who he wants to apologize to or feel the comfort of again, in however intangible a way. And we can see him speak directly to us in a way that actors very rarely do, of course. On you must never break the fourth wall. You must never look out into the audience directly at them through the camera, but you can do that on this one.
You know, I was not sure going into this, because I had a basic familiarity with the story, and I thought, well, I don't know. I know what's going to happen. I sort of know in the end he will ultimately be okay. I have to say, though, it's almost worse. That tension is almost heightened by the fact that you're waiting for the thing to happen. and you're famously used music to great effect in most of your films. There's a point, though, where it gets very quiet, and it feels like that quiet that happens when you are all alone somewhere, and it really sort of... That quiet rings louder almost than any of the music that you use.
Yeah, it's the dynamic range of cinema is a wonderful thing that you never quite get on any other medium, not really. Well, I suppose you do on radio, of course. I apologize.
That's all right.
Radio listeners. But yeah, it is a wonderful thing to explore in cinema. And we camped out in the Real Canyon for about a week. And for a city dweller like me, it was terrifying how quiet it was. It's very unsettling. And so we tried to exploit that range as much as possible. With a film like this, which is very reductive, a guy in a canyon alone for most of the film, you have to provide as much contrast as possible. And some of that is audio as well, is that, you know, the range of things that he experiences or that the audience experience, from pop music, thrilling pop music like you just heard in a bit of that trailer, and you know, to the intense quiet and stillness as he leaves these messages. And his voice is as close as you can ever imagine a voice being, you know. And you're not going to have other characters to play with, so you try and use other elements that you can, including James's range as an actor.
Academy Award-winning director Danny Boyle is my guest. We'll resume our conversation in a moment.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
Welcome to Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Thank you. They love us.
Is the right answer!
Doctors, lawyers never get beyond 16,000 rupees. He's on 10 million. What can a slum dog possibly know?
We went on the show because I thought she'd be watching. She's my destiny.
That, of course, is a clip from director Danny Boyle's Academy Award-winning 2008 film Slumdog Millionaire. His new one is called 127 Hours. I know that you work with composers and with music supervisors. How directly are you involved, though, with selecting the music for your films?
Oh, it's everything, really. It's like people say, what's your favorite bit of filming? Is it like filming or editing? It's neither of those. It's putting the music on. That's my favorite bit. I love the use of music in movies, and I choose everything, really. I mean, I take advice from people, and sometimes people suggest things, which I'm very, very grateful for. And then I've learned over the last few films, actually, to use composers in a more conventional way with invisible music, when sometimes the music in a film is working on you and you barely know it's there. Whereas what I'd previously done is always very, very self-confident pop music, really, with a very deliberate tone, either contradicting the film at a certain point for ironic reasons, or enforcing the mood, or, you know, trying to sustain energy, or whatever it was. But now I use, and we were very fortunate to get on this A.R. Rahman, who did the music for Slumdog Millionaire, and is a massive composer in the Bollywood film industry. But he's also he's a bit of a genius, really, and he was very pleased to be offered this, because, of course, he doesn't have any obvious connection with a Midwestern story like this, but or a Western state story, I should say. But his language is music, and it's universal, you know, so why not? And he does a wonderful job on it, yeah.
It is interesting about music, because it has almost the same effect as a drug would have. You know, it really can change your mood, and it, unlike a drug, you're experiencing the same thing as everyone else in the room with you.
Yes, and we have also, in addition to that, which is its adrenaline effect connected with pictures, there's also a collective memory of music. When you use pop songs from the past at all, and like we use a Bill Withers song, mm-hmm. Lovely Day, which is a great standard. Now, my daughters are 25 and 19, and they weren't born when that song was out. But when they watched the movie, they recognised the song. They had that kind of, they knew it was being used ironically. And it was like, I thought, how do they know that? How do they know that song? And there's this library that we collect as a people of our music, our pop music, since, well, I guess, 50 years, really. And it's a wonderful tool for a filmmaker to use, and more increasingly people use it. When I started, it wasn't quite so common. I mean, Scorsese pioneered it, really, in films like Goodfellas, which is a litany of different songs from different eras and, you know, taking you through. But I'm very proud of that in film. And it was initially despised as being rather a bit MTV-ish. But actually, I think it's much more important than MTV. It's part of our consciousness that we play with, and we can allow it to be used ironically or appropriately. You know, it's depending on the mood of the film and what moment in the film it is. I love that about music, you know.
Let's go take an email now. We have one from Bill, who wants to know, when you were filming in Utah, to what extent were you influenced by John Ford?
Oh, my goodness me. Well, there's a filmmaker. Interestingly, John Ford used to shoot so that nobody else could edit the films, so they could only be edited in one way. So that the way he controlled the studio trying to influence his films is he'd shoot a bit of a scene, but he wouldn't shoot the other bit.
So that he left no choice.
So there was only one way you could cut it. Genius. I mean, the West and those images of the West are indelible for all of us, really. We're talking about the collective memory of film. There's a collective memory of music. There's a collective memory of film as well. I mean, we tried to make it as modern an experience as possible, because he is this film begins in 2003, and interestingly, another big movie out at the moment is Social Network, mm-hmm. which also begins in 2003 with another very, very bright guy, because Aaron Ralston was an Intel engineer, and another bright guy, this guy Mark Zuckerberg, was on the East Coast plotting, as it turned out, Facebook. Aaron Ralston's on the West Coast or the Western States, and he is like turning his back. He turns his back on his career with Intel and actually becomes, you know, he doesn't want to be in a box. He wants to be in the wilderness. And it's quite interesting, those two, the contrast of those two. But we wanted it to be a very modern story. And his experience of the landscape would be not classic. It would be visceral. And like extreme sports has turned into. So it becomes, rather than it being pictorial and landscapey, it becomes more experienced and more tasted, really. And he crashes his bike and laughs it off, takes pictures of himself. He doesn't really take pictures of the beautiful landscape. He takes pictures of idiosyncratic bits of it, like an S-log, like him lying on the floor. And eventually, of course, extraordinarily enough, he concludes his time in the canyon by taking a picture of the hand he leaves behind, which we didn't make up. It's absolutely true. The picture is in his book. So it was more his vision of that world, which he claims occasionally is traditional wilderness and would be classic John Fordish. But actually, we wanted to give a much more modern, visceral experience of for the audience.
I want to talk about the scene where he takes his arm. And I read somewhere that you said that you knew that if people had to look away, the film was ruined.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure people do look away. But what I meant was that I thought the only way that you could experience what he has to do on a cinema screen and not look away or not leave, walk out, was that if in some way you were involved in it, in the sense that you were urging him to do it. And I think the idea of it becoming an immersive first-person experience for the audience, that you literally accompany James Franco through this whole experience, is that by the time you get there, on all the avenues have been closed off, all the possibilities are shut down, you go, okay, we've got to get through this together, do it, just do it. And I think, I hope that's how the film works. That was always the intention. And it means that you can represent what he does, not you don't sensationalise it, which turns it into a horror movie, a gore fest, but nor do you trivialise it by making it look easy or quick, neither of which it was. And most importantly, that it's a journey. And this is only a little part of it, because the door that it leads to is where the real journey ends. It's not like... The danger with a scene like this is it becomes the be-all and end-all of the film.
Yeah.
Everybody talks
yeah.
about it, and it becomes the reason for the film. In fact, it's a passageway to euphoria. And Aaron calls it ecstasy, and some extraordinary sense of life being given you back at the last moment, the possibility to keep life going, you know?
At least he's not going to die there.
Yes, as he puts it, yeah. He says that in the book, actually. We didn't do it. We did that line and we cut it. I don't know why we cut it in the end. But he just said, at one point, he says, Aaron, you are not going to die here, as he walks away from this place. Because he still thought he might well die unless he met people. He was unlikely to be able to fully get out of the big canyon that this canyon is attached to, which is Horseshoe Canyon, which is an enormous, deep canyon that he'd have to climb out of. And I don't think he'd have had the resources to do that. But he meets this Dutch family who are out trekking. Extraordinarily enough.
And they look terrified, as anybody would.
You can imagine this guy stumbling towards you like out of a horror movie. But he does have this wonderful line where he says, I need help. And for a guy like that to admit that proves how far he's come, you know, on this journey that nature or fate has put him through.
Director Danny Boyle is my guest. Let's go to Will in Dallas. Hi, Will.
Hey. Big fan.
Oh, hello, Will. Thank you.
Actually, I heard that John Ford question, and I immediately emailed my dad, because I was pretty sure that was him, and it was, so, anyway. Yeah, he's not a filmmaker, he's an attorney, anyway. Probably be embarrassed. My question was, in the trailer, there's that scene of James Franco, Kate Mara, and Amber Tamblyn sort of falling through that chasm into the, I guess it's like an underground lake of some sort.
Yeah.
When you're shooting scenes like that, how do you manage to pull that off? Because I imagine, I mean, I don't think you're actually falling through chasms like that. Do you have to build a set like that, or were they actually falling in real, I guess, caverns?
Yeah, no,
heavily insured.
yeah. No, it's two bits actually, but they're both real. They're in different places, and we edit them together. So the chasm that they slip through as he lets go, and then they eventually let go as they slide through a kind of sandwich of rock. Is actually in Canyonlands. That's in southern Utah. The pool itself is actually this extraordinary place at Heber, which is about 40 minutes from Salt Lake City, which is like has been it's like a prehistoric cave which has been there for ever. It's a volcanic pool, very warm. And the divers, when the divers went down, we had safety divers there because it is very dangerous still, that big drop. They would swim down to the bottom and they would put their hand in the silt underneath and it was red hot underneath. Amazing. There's a lot of insurance, as Chris said, and there's a lot of stunt people around to ensure safety. And the actors end up doing as little of it as much of it as they will, as they're prepared to do, and as we are, and we take advice on this, and as we're prepared to let them do. And the rest of it you do through stunt performers who are prepared to take those physical risks. It's interesting in the film because it's great fun, Will, to watch that, and that was one of the ideas at the beginning of the film. It's a fantastic adrenaline rush, but it's actually quite reckless what he's doing. And there is a reckless side of him which he acknowledges really as he goes on through the film, where he's been prepared to seeking out these very, very dangerous moments. And soon one will go wrong, and of course it does just when he's least expecting it, when he's on an easy hike through this canyon.
There's such a great irony to that scene, too, because later on when he's, you know, and you do an amazing job of showing us the bottom of the water bottle as, you know, he's got just milliliters left. And then we're thinking back to this moment where he had all the water in the world.
Yeah, and he left right at the beginning of the film, he leaves the tap dripping at home, which we sometimes do. And that water now would be everything to him if he could only have it, yeah. We tried to saturate the beginning of the film with water images constant. And then and the end of the film, he's in a swimming pool so that the beginning, the middle of the film, which is when he has the problems, you dry out and you make as arid as possible, both in sound, in picture, everything. You try and make feel dry and dry and drier, so that, again, we tried to make the audience feel the experience as well, as rather than just watch it objectively. James Franco go through it, you want to kind of experience it with it if you can. So yes, you put the camera inside the water, so it's long, you're aware of how little there is left now and how desperately he will seek out even that last drop, you know.
So while Franco's character, Aaron, is there, we never leave the crevasse except in his imagination. And usually it is imagination mixed with some memory. We don't see his mom calling, you know, from somewhere, or anybody setting out to search for him. What did you have to think about as you set out on this, knowing that you would be in the same physical location that is so cramped and sort of, you know, it's uniformly brown with some light coming into it, in terms of keeping the film visually interesting? Because it is visually interesting, but how did you manage that?
I always thought you should, when something is so reductive like this, I think the way to go is not to try and reduce the reductive nature of it. It's actually, that sounds very odd, contradicting in terms, but you see what I mean? Not to change that and to try and open up the film, but to actually embrace the limitations. And I thought that was somehow organically true to his experience and his story, so that you embrace everything that he went through and try and find a cinematic language that lets you express it. What you've got, of course, is you've got an amazing actor in the middle of it. And what I hadn't realised is, until we started doing it, is just how physical the film can be. And if you have the right cameras to capture that, it becomes, as we hoped it always would be, an action hero, an action movie where the hero can't move, where he's actually, but yet it's still full of propulsion, momentum, and certainly trying. And that expresses his spirit. He tries everything to get out of there. And that's what I meant about the avenues being closed off. You need him to explore every single thing he can do, including drinking his own urine, everything that he can do to survive, to see that they're all closed off before the final act has to happen, which you know is going to happen at the beginning of the film, like you say, because people know the story. But it allows you to go on that journey of seeing, yeah, I can see that, I can see. He had no choice. We have to do this together now. Let's do it. And yeah, so that's what we try to do, really. And you need an actor who's got many variants of in his tonal range, and you need to help it with music, the changes you can make, the rhythm of the editing, the dynamic of sound, all the different tools that you can use to change it. And then you try and personalise as many other things as possible, the water, the ants, every single element you try and make as important as possible. You give them their own close-up, if you like.
You do tease us in the film, and I won't give this scene away because it's something that people won't be expecting, but suffice it to say, we think for a moment that by some miracle, this is going to turn out better than we expected.
Yes.
And what's so brilliant about that is that it makes it all the more crushing when you realize that that's not actually going to happen for him.
Yeah, you've even got to close off. You've got to open up false hope and close it off as well. That's another avenue you've got to get rid of, really. And it's wonderfully touching because when it happens, he uses it to go and see this girl who, I mean, it's very ordinary kind of thing, really. There's this girl who's in love with him, clearly, and he hasn't responded really. And it's not that that's so wrong. It's just that he hasn't been careful with her emotions, really. He hasn't been tender with her, you know, her vulnerability. And he has learnt how necessary that is to be, you know, to make a decent job of life. You've got to respect that. You know, you've got to, you don't have to return love. You know, who knows what dictates love, but you have to be careful with her emotions. And he's heartbroken now himself for having broken her heart. And that's the path towards grace for him, in a way, that will allow him to eventually get out of here. So the false hope as a dramatic technique is used to be exciting, and it's also put to good dramatic use as well in terms of the development of the character.
Is it any different fundamentally to adapt something that was a memoir as opposed to something that was a novel?
Woo, yes. The challenge of working with a real life is... very interesting. You have to balance respect. This is this person's story, which they will always be part of, whereas you are going to be doing whatever you're going to be doing in a year's time. You're going to have moved on. But you also have to have a certain amount of freedom to make it as a feature film so that you are not trapped. You're not shadowed too much. The shadow does not fall too greatly of behavioural facts, especially. I mean, we're very accurate to the equipment he was given and the space he was in and things like that. But you want James Franco to experience it as well. Otherwise, you won't really believe it. You'll see him playing out a role if he's constantly looking over his shoulder, thinking, "What did Aaron do? What did Aaron do here? What did he do there?" So we wanted a certain amount of freedom to occupy the story as well as respectfully, as we do, handing it back to Aaron at the end and saying, "Thank you for letting us tell it our way."
Academy Award-winning director Danny Boyle is my guest. His new film is called 127 Hours. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
What's on the menu this evening, sir?
Your favourite dish?
Excellent.
Usual table, sir?
Oh, why, thank you.
Would sir care to pay for his bill in advance?
No, stick it on my tab.
I regret to inform, sir, credit limit was reached and breached quite some time ago.
Oh, well, in that case...
Ah, hard currency. That'll do nicely.
Can't be too careful, we're dealing with your type, can we, sir? Would sir care for a starter, some garlic bread, perhaps?
No, thank you. I'll proceed directly to the intravenous injection of hard drugs, please.
As you wish, sir. As you wish.
That is a clip from Danny Boyle's 1996 film Trainspotting. His new film is called 127 Hours, and he's here with us talking about it. I'm curious, now that you've been at this for a while, if the completion of each film gives you any different feeling about the ones that you have made before.
You bump into yourself making films. It's very odd. I have this kind of stated belief of trying to make each film very differently than the last one, but of course you end up bumping into it. You meet yourself in a corridor. It's very strange. You think, I've been here before, I've done this before, and they do resemble each other sometimes, even though they're not meant to. Like Slumdog was meant to be, you know, Slumdog and this film were meant to be as highly contrasting as you could ever possibly imagine, from the chaos of all the millions of people in Mumbai to this one guy in a canyon. But actually, there are many things in the films that are very similar. The life spirit and the importance of people ultimately at the beginning and the end, and overcoming odds, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it's interesting the way they follow each other around. One of the problems is that there are certain favourites people have. Like, a big favourite is 28 Days Later, and people know more about the movies than you do. They start asking you things, or you hear clips like this, which you haven't heard from a while, and you think, well, God, I hope she doesn't ask me about that. I'm not quite sure I remember that, really. So they fade a bit, really, and that's probably a good thing, because it's a weird thing about directing. You are entrusted with a story, and yet the people who are going to experience it are only going to see it once. You've seen it thousands of times, and yet somehow you're meant to know what it's going to be like for those people seeing it once.
Yeah.
And yet you're the worst person qualified to do that. And It was interesting, there was a sequel made to 28 Days Later called 28 Weeks Later, and I wasn't very involved in it, and although I supported it very strongly. And when I watched it much more like a punter, like an ordinary person in the audience. It was great. I thought, oh, I see what people like in this kind of film. Whereas I'd made one previously and never had that feeling in making it, you know. So it's a strange sensation directing.
It's got to be strange, too, if you run into someone who has just seen something that you made 15 years ago and is really identified with it and wants to engage on a level that, as you say, you know, things fade from memory or, you know, it's not top of mind.
The worst example I had in it, I was in Uzbekistan. I was doing some kind of research for Medicine Sans Frontier about a multi-drug-resistant TSB, TB drug use that they were doing there. And it was in a terrible, devastated place called Munyak, which is by the Aral Sea, which has shrunk to a quarter of its size because of overuse. And it's a terrible, blighted place. And we were in what was really the only shop within about 100 miles. And I kid you not, in the on the counter, kind of hidden away, so we hadn't done it deliberately, hadn't been tipped off I was coming, there was a copy of Trainspotting. And it was clearly a pirated copy. You know, it wasn't a legal copy. And the translator explained to the shopkeeper who I was, and the guy just grabbed it and said, sign it, like this. And to my shame,
I signed
the pirate copy. I was like so taken aback by what was going on, the way the things were happening. So, it's funny having a history. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it catches up with you sometimes.
We'll go back to the phones now. This time we have Howard on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Howard.
Hey. Listen, I don't want to sound like I'm gushing or anything, but Mr. Boyle, for me personally, your work on Sunshine was a delight. It was beautiful. And my question was, and you guys have kind of already highlighted it, to my shame, is the major themes in Sunshine, the battle for survival against all these hopeless odds and everything. You know, it would strike me that you would sort of use a similar sort of creative lens tools that you used in Sunshine for this new movie and sort of the survival aspect. And so I was just wondering if you maybe highlighted many of those or if you simply went to the book for literally everything you needed.
Yeah, no, interesting. Thank you, Howard. I'd love to bump into you in a corridor because not many people saw Sunshine, so I'm always delighted.
Trying to save the sun when the sun is threatened.
Yeah, the idea, the premise of the film is that the sun is dying, and we set 50 years in the future, and we send a mission to try and reignite the sun, which is a pretty ambitious thing to want to do, but of course it's the movies, and you can try and do that. It was very interesting, Howard, because that was a very different film in one sense, and it's a very cinematic film in a conventional sense, and we shot it on film. Whereas this film felt very small scale initially, and shot on digital cameras, small digital cameras, very intimate space and very intimate experience. And you try and hope that the resonance of the story explodes it out from there. Whereas Sunshine was a very big visual film, really, you know, dealing with the source of all life in the universe. You can't get much bigger, really. But yeah, that's what I was just saying about you bump into yourself. You realize, yeah, that's a film about survival as well, on a kind of physics level, whereas this is a survival on the level of a dull blade, really, a dull penknife that he has.
It's interesting when you talk about a film that is sort of grand and very visual and spectacular, because it used to simply be that maybe you'd have to think about what something would look like in the DVD version later on a television set. Now people are watching movies on their phones and in tiny little screens. Do you just have to not even think about that when you're putting something together to look great on a very large screen?
Yeah, I think so, especially for our generation who are just making the adjustment is something that's ongoing. You can't, whereas a new generation will be brought up like that and they will make the necessary adjustments, whatever it is they do, we'll try and hopelessly copy at the end of our careers, but they'll be inhabiting it as something organic that they're developing. So it's easy for us to despair about this great cinematic tradition is being reduced to the size of an iPhone. But actually, of course, people will come along who'll use it so creatively, they'll reinvent cinema, they'll renew cinema through these other mediums, through iPads or whatever it is that they're gonna do it through, you know, through sharing stories, through changing stories, through segmented stories. And like the segments that they're going to make films in, I think, so that you can digest them, you know, on the way to work. So it's a 15-minute digestion of a film rather than the whole 90-minute experience, so we'll do them in segments. That's Dickens. Charles Dickens wrote like that.
It came out in the paper, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it just came out, and then you got another segment, and it's what led to him being such an exciting writer, because he had to have a climax at the end of each week to make you, or end of each day, so that you'd come back to the story the next time. And so it'll always keep changing. But yeah, you'd love them. I mean, this film, 127 Hours, I'd love people to see in the cinema, because that sense of being... of it being inescapable is something unique in cinema, because we have this really weird thing. We pay $12 or whatever it is you pay to get to the cinema, and then you voluntarily go and entrap yourself in this black box with a load of strangers, and unless it's appalling, you're not going to leave. You're going to stick it out. And so there's a nice connection there with James Franco's ordeal in this film, if we can, you know, and you'll never get that quite the same at home on TV or on your iPhone or wherever. It won't be quite the same. You won't get quite the same feeling of you experiencing it with him, I don't think, other than outside the cinema. So I hope people see it in the cinema.
There's one scene where James Franco, as Aaron, is realizing that his heart rate has accelerated a great deal. And I thought it was amazing, because when you first hear it, I thought there was something going on in the theater next door, because it's so remote and it sort of sounds like something, and it doesn't feel like it's directly related to what you're seeing. And then it grows and grows and grows. Yeah. And I don't think you'd get that at home.
No. And you have to be very careful with heartbeat, because it can be so cheesy, of course. It's so easy, so powerful. So we grow it from nowhere. He's obsessed in the book with how the speed that his heart is beating, because I think he's trying to monitor quite exactly when he's going to collapse and die, because he can feel these different... And he talks about his other organs collapsing. And he felt, by the end, he felt he must have been about just 15 minutes away from a heart attack. Mm. And indeed, it was one of the things that saved him, of course, because his blood thickened so much as he deteriorated, that when he actually did amputate the arm, the blood loss was reduced compared to had he succeeded the first time he attempts 3 days earlier. If he'd done it, then he probably would have bled to death, because his blood loss would have been much greater. One of the ironies of the story, you know, just like meeting this Dutch family who had just happened to be looking at the petroglyphs and taking photographs of them, the famous petroglyphs in the Great Gallery there. That's a complete coincidence that... who knows who controls those kind of things? But whoever does, at one point, Franco does say thank you to whoever it is who's orchestrating all this.
So obviously Aaron Ralston told his story to the whole world. He wrote a memoir about it. Still, we are trained from a very young age not to ask certain kinds of questions of people, because they might make them uncomfortable, they might make them sad, they might be rude. Were there things that you had to talk to Aaron about for purposes of making the film and getting things right, that you had to sort of jump over that place and just ask away because you needed to know this information?
Yes, I did. And I don't know whether you wanted me to talk about them on the show on live radio.
You don't have to if there are things that are between you and him. But I wonder, even, you know, did you have to psych yourself up for that process?
Yeah, you do. You do. You have to say, look, we are going to, James and I are going to have the responsibility of telling your story completely intimately. And we need to know everything. We need to know about every girlfriend. We need to know every intimate detail of what went on in that canyon so that we can choose to include them or exclude them. I mean, there are things mentioned in the... What's extraordinary is there are no number twos, as they put it, which is included in the film. And that's extraordinary to think, you know, so you have to know everything. And there's a very beautiful scene where he looks back at the footage of these girls swimming in the pool, and he has recorded them, of course. But now, of course, it becomes a sensual thing, a loneliness, a longing for company, for the sensuality of a woman. And just their voices become almost erotic to him in a way, in this lonely, lonely time he is in the canyon. But we try to use it in a way, in a tasteful way, that actually represents a continuing part of his longing for people, you know, which is part of his healing process, really, as he's learning about himself and how much he needs other people.
What do you have to engage with in the world to make sure that you're keeping your eyes open for the next great thing? Given that your films are all so different, I would imagine people don't necessarily send you ideas that match very well with what you've done before.
You try not to think like that. If you're, you try not to be an agent looking for looking for material. You've got to live life like everybody leads it. You know, I'm sure you're influenced by what you can bring to work, what stories you can bring from the outside world. But you also have to live as a real person and inhabit the world. And the best thing to trust is the way sometimes things pop, and they just, you can't escape them, and they just keep coming back at you. And they're the best ones. They'll sustain you better than trying to cherry pick the best ideas, or, oh, that's good, we could cast him, or that's sexy, or, you know, that'll be popular, or what the cinema needs now is this. I think they'll all lead to disaster, actually. They might lead to financial reward, but they'll probably be disastrous in some way. So you're best just following your instincts, really, and to keep those instincts as free as possible. Having said that, this job ruins some of your life, because you tend to meet people and you are thinking, oh, would this story make a film? And which is a terrible thing to be thinking. And also, when you go and watch movies, if they're not great movies, which everybody loses themselves in a great movie, but if they're not, you are just looking at them technically the whole time, thinking, they did that like that, they did this, they did that, you know. So those are the drawbacks, but they're minor, you know.
So I want to talk about something that is not entirely unrelated, but you are doing the opening ceremonies for the 2012 Olympics in London.
I am indeed.
Do you expect that to be a really cinematic experience? And how do you balance the fact that you have this huge stadium audience and you have the rest of the world watching it on a little screen?
I know. That's the key thing, actually. You've gone right to the heart of it there. It's also, we're following Beijing, which is in itself...
over the top.
A very important decision to make. How do you follow Beijing? Because Beijing was the climax, really, the zenith of a type of opening ceremony, which began really with Los Angeles and has outdone itself every time. It's like, we've got to go bigger. We've got to do this. And you can't go bigger than Beijing, because they had literally, God knows what they spend, and God knows how many people they employed. And with a military economy, almost a militaristic economy, dictating how they could
just make it the biggest.
Yeah. So we've decided to, it's a great way to restart, really. It's a good moment to restart on behalf of not just ourselves and what we can afford, but on behalf of everybody who's going to come after us as well, that we can restart again, go back to the beginning again. So we're going to try and make it slightly more personal. The stadium itself is, although it holds the same number of people as Beijing, 80,000, its footprint is half of what Beijing's was. So it's a much more intimate stadium, and we want to use that. I don't want to make it too cinematic, because I think that would be a bit obvious, really. I think it should be a live event, and I think the people that we should look after initially should be the 80,000 people in the stadium, really, for the live event, and hopefully TV will catch up nicely.
Danny Boyle's new film is called 127 Hours. Danny, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.